Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 54, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 613. Okay. So, you know, you've got this pair of papers, remember, that are a block unto themselves. You had the first paper that laid out the basics of the rebellion. And now, as is obvious from the title, they want to talk a little bit about the consequences of that rebellion, positive and negative. And, you know, it's very important to keep in mind that, you know, in supremacy there are no coincidences. Another way to think about that is that everything, when all is said and done, should have been. Doesn't mean it was predestined, not simplistic like that, but everything that happens, no matter what it is a potential to actualize supremacy. Everything. No exceptions.
It doesn't happen. It isn't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When all is said and done, right. I mean, oh, I guess that didn't happen because that is not part of actualizing supremacy. Yeah. I mean, if it's part of actualizing supremacy, it has to happen somewhere, someplace, period. Because there's no magic that's going to fill in a, you know, an empty spot in the whole picture. You know, that's the key, especially when things are very, very dark, like the orgy of darkness and death, as they say. Can you stand courageously and independently enough in the face of such facts to see the potentials there? Or are you a hopelessly subjective phenomenon that is just immediately absorbed into the negative aspects of it and find no potentials in it whatsoever? It seems to be just an infinite blackness of actuality as opposed to an infinite whiteness of potentiality. That's the test. Bottom line, everything about your entire universe career from here to eternity is that test. Your whole existence from here to eternity has absolutely nothing to do with, wonder what I'm going to do with something that is innately positive to begin with. That's not what you are. You know, you're a creature that is doing the other part of the whole. What am I going to do with that which isn't perfect and complete to begin with? You know? When you see problems of the Lucifer Rebellion, which way do you think about that? As a negative actuality or a positive potentiality? You know, when you see that, you go, well, actually, to me, that says potentials of the Lucifer Rebellion. Can you see it that way? As opposed to, yeah, once again, I'm a victim. You should feel sorry for me or whatever. It's like, no. I mean, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay, so we'll start with this preface. Go ahead and read both paragraphs of that preface, and then we'll process them, the whole thing together.
Paper 54, Problems of the Lucifer Rebellion. Evolutionary man finds it difficult fully to comprehend the significance and to grasp the meanings of evil, error, sin, and iniquity. Man is slow to perceive that contrastive perfection and imperfection produce potential evil, that conflicting truth and falsehood create confusing error. That the divine endowment of free will choice eventuates in the divergent realms of sin and righteousness. That the persistent pursuit of divinity leads to the kingdom of God as contrasted with its continuous rejection, which leads to the domains of iniquity. The gods neither create evil nor permit sin and rebellion. Potential evil is time existent in a universe embracing differential levels of perfection, meanings, and values. Sin is potential in all realms, where imperfect beings are endowed with the ability to choose between good and evil. The very conflicting presence of truth and untruth, fact and falsehood, constitutes the potentiality of error. The deliberate choice of evil constitutes sin. The willful rejection of truth is error. The persistent pursuit of sin and error is iniquity.
Okay, now, I'm sure we're going to be on this preface for a while this evening, because we should be. As they started out, evolutionary man finds it difficult fully to comprehend the significance and to grasp the meanings of evil, error, sin, and iniquity. Okay, trying to tell you very first statement that you basically need to erase everything in your mind about those four words and see if you can start from scratch. Because humans have been nothing but confused about this. Not only that there's four words that you've got to differentiate, but just you know, even if you blurred them all together, what you're talking about at all. Basically, not even close has been man. Okay? You've got to try to find a way to get at these things in a fresh, objective perspective. And the revelators throughout the entire book don't serve this up in simplistic fashion. They give you what you need, where through reflection and through synthesizing everything in the book, you can begin to figure out what is the foundational nature of each of these concepts, and then what ways in the book are they using them in a derivative fashion, you know, rather than in an originating, you might say, you know, or a foundational or a fundamental fashion. Even in this preface, they do that. And you're going, well, if they start out saying you're really confused about this, why would they inject potential confusion just right away? Like it says at the beginning of the foreword, more or less distortion of meaning. Right? You have to find the interpretation that is holistically integrous. And the only way you can do that is just jump in somewhere and start working out from that point and be constantly in a mode of trying to refute. It's like, well, maybe it means this, you know, but you read some more in another place in the book, it's like, oh, that's not working. Okay, so that must not be it. Well, maybe this is the foundational thing, and this is the derivative. You go in some other place, no, that doesn't work either, because that doesn't make sense there. You've got to slowly work through this until finally you figure out how to sort it out. Now, you know, this great big chart that's on the top of the pile sitting next to me here all the time refers to these issues. It attempts to put them into that threefold actuality with unity pattern. And, you know, you can always go on in the library right, on the website, get a copy just like this one of that threefold actuality with unity chart. You'll see that we're touching on stuff that's in field number two in that chart. We're not going to actually, do this like a class sort of a thing and try to engage that chart directly. That's something that we do approach in a more precise way in the Finding Cosmic Calibration summer presentation. So if you haven't taken that, think about doing that next summer. But let's just go through the basics of this so that we can start to get clear on these issues. So you have to start with a very rudimentary element of reality. When you first start to sort things out, you do just that. You differentiate, and there's individuality. There's this object and that object, or at least so it appears to you. And so you say the existence of that object is a fact, and the existence of that object is a fact. You bring in this idea of factness. You say something is a fact. And you start to work with that, and you recognize that there's an external world and there's an object in that external world, and you have a representation of that object that's put in your mind. You don't know exactly how that happens, but in some mysterious way, the external world gets represented in your mind, and you become aware of that representation. And you also, as you start to work with this, you discover, I can get things that I can maybe even very directly visualize in my mind that I can tell are not actually in the external world. I have an imagination. And I can get these individuality forms in my mind that are either predicated on something in the external world, so that they're a sensation in my mind of that object in the external world, or they might just be totally in my mind and not a representation of the external world at all. Unicorns aren't actually in the external world, at least on this planet, right? But I can visualize one in my mind, right, and draw a picture of it. And so you start with this first initial recognition of this differential, this twofoldness, where on the one hand you have fact, and on the other hand you can give a non-fact form in your mind. And you need a word for what that non-fact, that is a literal form in that mind energy system, that's a figment. Right? Like we talk about a figment of your imagination. Right? So you start with that simple recognition, that factual recognition, that there's fact on the one hand and figment on the other hand. And it's just about whether or not that individuality form is actually related to the external world, or it's just been produced totally internally. Okay? With not having to go through any sort of sensory mechanism translation or anything. Okay. So, but then it drives home the point. Okay, and when I say fact and figment, those aren't, the direct opposites are fact and non-fact. Objectively, there's a fact or not. Okay. Figment is just in the mind. Figment doesn't exist objectively in the external world. There aren't figments floating around out there. Okay? It's only the mind. There's two other words that are like the word figment, only they're related to the other two phases of the threefold actuality. If figment is about an individuality form, you're going to have a parallel one that's about associativity and a parallel one that's about unity. Okay, those words are error and evil, respectively. So, see, in order to start to figure out what error and evil are, you need to see them in their threefoldness. There's figment, error, and evil, respectively. Individuality, associativity, unity. Okay, and there's positive words that are parallel to fact. There's truth and goodness. Fact, truth, goodness. You know, so objectively, you have facts, truths, and goodnesses. Okay, and those can be represented in the mind as an individuality form, an associativity form, or a unity form. These different ways that your mind can take the form that's related, directly related to that phase of external world, of objective reality. So objectively, there's truth and there's goodness. Now, in contrast, I can put my mind in a form that is the kind of form that if things were positive, it would be truth. But instead I have it in an opposite sense. In a negative way, it's formed like that. I can give an untruth form in my mind, just like I can give a non-fact form in my mind. If I give untruth form in my mind, that's error. Just like giving a non-fact form in my mind as a figment. Likewise, you don't have to just call it untruth. We've coined a non-negated word, right, to indicate untruth, falsehood. And you might notice, it'll come up a little later, falsehood uses that hood suffix that suggests wholeness. So, interesting little twist. It's like, well, maybe this truth-falsehood thing is a little bit more than just the associativity. We'll talk about that a little later. But you can give untruth, falsehood, form in your mind. That's error. Error does not exist in the external world. There's no error floating around out there. It's only inside mindal selves. Same way with the unity phase. You can give ungoodness, which we also call badness, form in your mind. That form is evil. Again, evil doesn't exist in the external world. And at that point, you go, well, wait a minute. No, that's not right. Yes, it is. Right? This is where it starts to really challenge what you've always been told and what humans have always believed. You know, especially if they're related to a religion that has a Zoroastrian flavor to it or something like that, or at least ties back to the most ancient sorts of things of dual spiritism. Salem. Right? If you've got good and bad. You know, as objective things. You know, there's white ooze out there and there's black ooze out there, you know, and you want the white ooze to go in your ears and not the black ooze. You know, that's the normal way that humans rationalize this. No, there is no evil or even badness literally out there. You don't become infected by anything. Right? It's an abstract thing. Abstractly, there's badness. And if you can give that form in your mind. It's like, well, how can that be? Well, because ultimately you have absolute sovereignty over that mindal domain. You can do with it whatever you will. If you want that mind energy system that you have sovereignty over to have absolutely no relationship to reality, ta-da!
You got it.
You are absolutely sovereign there. You can overrule infinite deity. You can overrule everything and be whatever you will. Yep.
Well, for me, Don is in the external world.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's got evil, so
an evil form in his mind itself. Yeah.
Is that not evil for me? No, Don is.
Right, but his mind itself, no more than my mind itself, is the objective domain. Right? Out there is the objective order. In each of our minds is the subjective order. Right?
Okay, so it would be just a fact then, if I viewed it, if I assessed it truthfully, it would just be an external fact.
Yeah, I mean, it is an objective fact that he has a mind itself.
Yeah.
So do I. Right? But, you know, you can see we're not trying to understand someone else's mind itself here.
Okay.
You know, what you're trying to do is just, you know, understand that there's inside and outside. Okay, that's a definition relative to you, right? There's inside your mind itself and there's outside of your mind itself. You're just trying to understand that basic twofold inner life, outer life, you know, and recognizing that the words figment, error, and evil are about the inner life, not about the outer life. And especially that word evil, it's never been understood. That's only about the inner life. It has absolutely nothing to do with the outer life. I mean, you could say there's potential for evil in the outer life, okay, but not the actuality of it. Right. Okay, so that's the first big step. Now, as soon as you bring in evil, you've got these other two words, sin and iniquity.
Before you go on to those.
Yep.
There's this whole thing, you know, I think it's, you know, deity and reality, that whole aspect of things about perfecting, you know, that we are, so, you know, in a perfecting, finite universe, the evil, error part, is going to exist by virtue of the fact that we're starting out imperfect. Now these, it seems like what we're getting to here is a little bit, now, first thing you said was, the definition of them is something that, you know, before we had the revelation, people on this planet really didn't have a good understanding of. It's kind of,
they had no understanding, basically.
They had an understanding of what they had an understanding of, and that just wasn't right.
So they had notions about what these words mean, yeah. I mean, you can look up something in the dictionary.
Well, and most people inside them, because they have a part of it, know the difference between right and wrong, and what you want to call that. But my point here is, or my question here is, so now there's a whole different degree, I think, that you're about to come into, that's not so much a part of just the finite aspect of having that evil and error exist in an imperfect situation. There's a, you know, and the difference, I think, where you go when you get into sin and iniquity incorporates, you know, more of your individual free will, willingness, not to follow that small voice inside you, so to speak, that we happen to have.
Right. I mean, we haven't gotten, you know, we've been doing threefold actuality. We haven't done the, you know, with the triunity, you know, part. The, you know, we've gone through these individuality, associativity, unity blocks, but not this reality block down here, not this triunity block, or this personality block, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what you discover. I mean, and you don't know that immediately, because after all, there's a tendency, the way humans have used evil and sin, to actually use them in the opposite way that the revelators use them. And that slowly dawns on you as you study the revelation. It's like, wait a minute, I think they're using the word sin as a worse word than evil. And I've always had a tendency to use it the other way around. You know, I say there's sin and then there's evil, you know. Yeah. And why do you do that? Because, see, you definitely think that I'm, you know, you'll say I'm a sinner, right? So you localize that with you. But there's this tendency to make evil this infinite black ooze, so that it's bigger, see, and it becomes the bigger word. You falsely reify it like that. That's why humans tend to think of the evil as the greater word rather than sin. Okay? But see, that's what we're trying to do. It's like, no, the evil is about the inner life, not the outer life. There's no evil stuff out there, period. In all of infinity, not one iota of it is an actuality of evil.
That's why they say God doesn't experience evil.
Because there's no evil experience. It doesn't exist, right? So that's the first point at which you recognize you really have to, like, okay, wait a minute. I need to really let go of just nodding my head up and down, thinking I know what's going on here. It's like, this is probably going quite a bit different, right? And so you've got that. You see, an obvious reason why you couldn't even get what we've already said is there's never been a philosophy, there's never been a doctrine that had three elements in it. At best, there's been dualism, body and mind. See, so there's been no potential to understand the difference between error and evil, because there's just no worldview that's threefold like that. You say, well, yeah, people use the word spirit. Yes, they do, but if you reflect on how they're using it, they just, that's a kind of mind, the way they use that word spirit. They don't mean that there's literally this other substance in the external world that you can build buildings out of called spirit substance. No one uses the word spirit like that, right? No one has an actual threefold actuality worldview. So that's the biggie, is getting those differentiated into the three bins, if you will, of the threefold actuality: figment, error, evil. And at this point, you see, it's just threefold actuality. There's no personality yet encompassing this. There's no free will. See, so evil doesn't have anything to do with, in a direct way, with free will. It just has to do with if you are involved in that other substance. An animal's not involved in that other substance, so an animal can never give badness form in its mind. An animal can never be evil, because it has no relationship to spirit energy. Right? But you, completely unwittingly, have a relationship to spirit energy, and so the potential of putting your mind in that kind of a form, is there. An animal can't shape its mind energy system in a unity form. You can. It can do individuality and associativity, but not unity. So you introduce this, and now you've got the beginnings of a differentiation between error and evil. It's still a bit abstract, I recognize, but we'll talk about it a little bit more. But let's just go the rest of the way. Now, what if you take a hold of this evil form in your mind? You've given badness form in your mind. So there is a state of evil. There's a partiality of negative form in your mind that is properly called an evil form. But that was by no means any desire you had. You just unwittingly made a form like that. Most likely, the only reasons you made a bad, you gave badness form in your mind, you were trying to give goodness form in your mind, but you haven't been able to properly get them separated yet, and you gave what you thought, what appeared to be goodness form in your mind, but it's actually badness, right?
Starts with the figment, correct?
Yeah.
And the figment can't you sort of fend that off with the three cosmic intuitions, if you can bring them to bear, that we all have access?
Again, it's not like figment grows into error and error grows into evil. So if you stop figment, you prevent evil.
Okay.
No, these are three separate domains. You can go right at the unity with no individuality or associativity in play. You know, so you can start anywhere. You know, it's a threefold actuality. There's a fundamental separateness. Now, in terms of kind of thinking about your mind, you can kind of start with what's directly interfaced with the matter on the bottom, like if you use the hourglass analogy. You know, so it's going to be just kind of basic, you know, related to individuality, figment sort of stuff. Or you can start with what's interfacing with the top of the hourglass. So you'd start with evil, right? That's related to spirit, touching the top of the hourglass. Or maybe you just, you know, take what's naturally there from the boundary conditions on the top and bottom, and you're just kind of working in the middle, and you're confused, and there's error. You know, is it kind of just right there directly in the mind? Or are you starting with the spirit and bringing it down into the mind as evil? Are you starting with a, you know, a negative relationship to individuality with matter and bringing that up into mind as figment? You know, you start with a horse, that's actually in the external world, and it's like, well, I could imagine a horn on the horse. See, you know, you're starting with the matter, but then bringing it, you know, bringing something in your mind that that is a matter-like object that you've fancified. Right? Okay, so you got this figment, error, evil. Now, your personality. Okay, so what happens if you bring your personality into play? Personality is directly, immediately spirit pattern. Okay? Not material pattern or mindal pattern, but spiritual pattern. So when you think about applying that, it's starting with the badness that you've given form in your mind. You know, if you've got this form, what if you impose your personality upon that form? What if you purpose that? What if you add will to it? Okay, now the technical thing that you're adding to the form is pattern. But we don't need to get into the physics of form and pattern. But you're purposing that badness that you've given form in your mind. If you do that, now you have sin. See, I mean, if you've and let me just bring up a little comment. Another thing that you can get your hands on in the library that'll help you with this stuff that we're just talking about here is this this little sort of footnote that goes with the threefold actuality with unity chart that's called non-actuality and unreality. It's just a quick little note that I put down to help you with this reflection on these twofoldnesses that we're talking about here. You know, so you have that that ungoodness, you know, you're giving ungoodness form in your mind or badness form in your mind. Yeah. But if you're not just giving it form but purposing like this, adding pattern to it, identifying personality with it, you know, then instead of ungoodness, it's unrighteousness. Or instead of merely badness, it's wickedness.
Okay. Take the unicorn example.
Yep.
And show you how that. Can you follow that up to that far?
No. No. Unicorn doesn't have anything to do with. Okay. Yeah, it's just a figment.
That's just an error.
No, it does not have to do with error. Figment. You know, I mean, directly. It's just. Yeah, you know, we're just.
So, what's an example of what you're saying? I'm sorry.
Okay. If I mean. This is where you say it's very abstract. See, to actually get to what error and evil are, or even more, you know, say wickedness or whatever, you have to think quite abstractly, you know, because it's no longer just about, you know, white hats are good and black hats are bad, you know. Think about how we've tried to use all these words, apply all these words just to material things, to individuality. Some individuality we say is good and some is bad. See, and
purpose it, you know, I mean, do you mean actually act upon it?
No. To explain all this stuff would take us 5 hours, so I can't unpack all of this. I'm just trying to give you some of the proper words for this. to start thinking about it. Over the next 10 years, you can, as more you reflect on this, the more it starts to come together. It's that sort of a thing. It's just not an easy thing. Okay? It takes a long time to begin to get a feeling for these differences. But it helps to kind of get it started on the right track. By another way to think about what I mean about purposing it, think about if you have something that is that you're just relating to passing in the moment, possibly. But it doesn't have, you don't have to merely relate to it that way. You could take a hold of a way, in a way where you want it to relate to eternity. That's what I mean by you can purpose it. You're going to attempt to eternalize this. And why do you want to do this? Remember, the evil thing is about the relationship to unity, the continuumness. Just when you say unity, do you not think eternity? That probably is kind of really close at hand in your mind, just when you say unity, or even spirit, to think of eternity. The continuumness, what you initially see as sort of this backdrop of everything, the context in which everything exists, that you think of as being the essence of eternity that you're trying to strike step with. It could be a genuine continuumness, a genuine unity, or it could be one of your own construct. It could appear to be the unity in your mind, but it isn't really. Okay? But you want to definitively have a relationship to unity. So you take a hold of what appears to you to be the genuine unity. Okay? And you take a hold of it as if you were gripping eternity itself. You will never release your grip. You're taking a hold of it with your faith grasp that can grip unity. Okay? Well, what if that isn't genuine unity? What if it just appears to be unity to you? It appears to be goodness, and that's why you're gripping it, full white knuckle. But it isn't really goodness. It appears to be, but it's really badness. It feels just like, subjectively, badness and goodness in your mind feel the same. You have a discriminator to discriminate between the two, but it's not a subjective discriminator. It's an objective discriminator. You can use your cosmic intuitions to discriminate things, okay? But we're not bringing in that. We're just recognizing that subjectively, it's like, oh, man, that feels so continuous and so infinite. I want to absolutely identify with that. That's the unity. I want to melt into it. But it's really badness, even though you can't tell that. You've just given evil form in your mind. I mean, you're just given badness form in your mind. That's evil. When you take a hold of that and see, and if you literally grip it, it's like, and I'm going to predicate everything I do on this now. I'm going to purpose this relationship to unity. Now things are going further. Now the trick is, it gets kind of subtle.
Now you've been sin, basically.
Yeah, no, I was just going to get to that. Okay, for it to be genuinely sin, it has to actually be a recognition. You've technically taken a hold of badness for that evil to be in your mind, but you didn't. You thought it was goodness. Okay. But what if you take it another step and you actually get that objective discrimination in play? And that energy says, oh no, I know this feels like it's goodness, but see, it's actually badness. Oh yeah, I see that. Yes, but even though it's badness, wow, I really like the way that feeds to my selfishness. I like what I can do with that for the exaltation of me. So even though now I recognize its badness, you know, says who? If it's better for me, isn't that the definition of goodness? So now you're going to take a hold of it, okay, knowing that it's badness.
That's sin.
Okay, that's sin, you know, or wickedness. You know, you're getting wickedness form and purpose in your mind. Right? That's sin. Okay. So, I mean, you can tell we struggle a little bit to have the terminology to talk about this. I mean, because, you know, the only reason that you can have any relationship to spirit, I mean, it literally isn't, your body isn't made it out of it or something. The only reason you can have any relationship to spirit energy is if you use that faith grasp to take a hold of it. Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, do you take a hold of it? Do you take a hold of badness ignorantly, thinking it's goodness? Or do you take a hold of it deliberately, knowing that it's badness? Okay, and then it's sin, rather than just merely evil. And if you, you know, once you start with sin, if this continues to give you a positive feedback, yep, I really do like the way this redounds to me, let's do it again and again and again and again, and let's make it systemic. Let's make my entire nature so defined. Okay, if you actually achieve that fullness of sin, that's iniquity. And to think about the word iniquity, I mean, what does it mean literally? It means not equity. You know, iniquity is not equity. Remember, now we've talked about how...
what does equity mean?
Well, again, as I was just going to say, everyone thinks that equality and equity are synonyms.
So true.
But they're not. Right? Another thing that, you know, you've heard me stress this before. Another thing that you have to separate is you have to separate equity from equality. Equality is just about the spirit phase of the threefold. Equity is about the threefoldness. It's about the triunity. Equity means cosmic, not merely spiritual. Equality is just spiritual. Equity is triune. See, to be iniquitous is to be not cosmic. To have completely separated yourself from the cosmic system. To no longer be of the cosmos at all.
Detached.
You know, to be in non-equity, in non-cosmic form, that's iniquity. See, and again, the revelators use that word, even though humans have never known how to use it, because of its coinage. It's like, well, if I can teach the readers of this revelation what the word equity means in distinction from merely equality, I will likewise teach them that the word iniquity is exactly describes what that state is that we're talking about, that systemic unrighteous state. Right? You have no conformity to the cosmos anymore. You know, righteousness is conformity with the cosmos.
And you know better.
And you knew you were doing that. But remember, when you start going, you start out knowing this is goodness, this is badness, I picked this because it's badness. But when you go down a little ways, you become insane, and those are flipped.
And if you see it's bad, you don't turn it.
They proceed to look the opposite to you after a little while. And that's why you'll take it all the way to iniquity.
If it didn't
flip like that, where badness actually starts to look like goodness, you have an objective assessment that's been flipped. You aren't just ignorant, clueless, and grabbing hold of whatever. If it didn't flip like that, you'd never go all the way to iniquity. That's what drives you all the way to iniquity. And it appears that you're going to righteousness, and in a way you are, right? You've become the cosmos, right? It's not righteousness anymore, conformity with the cosmos. It's self-righteousness, conformity with self. A self that you have made so holistic that it appears to be the whole. You believe that you're the cosmos.
You become completely detached.
And you become completely cosmically insane, see? That complete self-righteous state. Okay? All right, so like I said, there's finding cosmic calibration that where we talk about some of this stuff in a little bit more detail. There's just those two handouts that you can find in the library. You can do a little reflection on your own. You want to keep those things in mind. Now let's just look at a couple of the items in here. When they started out, they said evil, error, sin, and iniquity in that order, in that first sentence, in the preface there. Now, the way I was just talking about it, it's saying, well, shouldn't they have said error, evil, sin, iniquity, so they would have had them in building order, getting worse and worse and worse? Because as you start to reflect on what I was just saying, in the threefold actuality, where you know that associativity, that middle element, has to do with a superadditive consequence, the relationship between individuality and unity. And when you think about that, it's like, well, okay, I could get error merely because I had figment in play. I gave goodness form in my mind, so that's fine. There's no evil. But if I relate that goodness with figment, I can get error. See? Instead of goodness with fact to get truth, I could relate goodness with figment.
You can't get error. You don't always get error.
You will always get error if you relate goodness with figment. That's what, I mean, it's just a super additive consequence. If you relate goodness and figment, you'll be in error. You're confused, right? You're trying to go about doing good, but your worldview is full of fairy tales, figments. Your actions will be erroneous, right? You must face facts and adjust them to ideals, right? I mean, you're not facing facts. You're treating figments as if they were facts. Right? But you can have mere error, where it's just that. Your goodness is given form in your mind by grace, to start with, that initial encirclement. Right? So it's just there. You don't even have to have gotten to it consciously. But at a very, immature age, you bring figment into play, and so there's going to be all kinds of confusion. There's going to be all kinds of error in your life because you don't have fact and goodness together. Okay, but error can be worse though, right? I mean, I could be definitively have a very factual picture in play, but there's badness. I've unwittingly taken a hold of badness instead of goodness. Okay, now not only is that if I given evil, badness form in my mind, not only is there evil, but if there's evil, obviously there's error. Right? Because again, I can't get the truth unless I have fact and goodness. Right? So if either of them is messed up, I get error. Right? So evil implies error, but error does not imply evil. Okay? Error might just be because there's figment in play, see, not evil. Okay. So there's that. And so when you see them like this, it's like, I'll bet you. They want, if they're going to talk about error here, it's only the error that's a result of, there's evil, so, there's also error. Well, yeah, we're talking about the Lucifer rebellion after all, right? Right. Yeah, it starts with evil, and error is there too. After all, you see at the end there, the persistent pursuit of sin and error is iniquity. It's like, well, we were just talking about evil to sin to iniquity. They're just reminding you. I mean, if there's evil, there's also error along for the ride. Can't help but be error along for the ride. And you see there the rest of that last clause, or I guess no, the second to last clause. The willful rejection of truth is error. You see that statement, and you go, oh, so they're defining it. Willful rejection of truth equals error. No, they're not necessarily saying that. The willful rejection of truth implies error, but error does not imply the willful rejection of truth. Remember, We're talking about error. I mean, it may have nothing to do with willfulness. Right? It can be a passive thing, if you will. Right? But, you know, I mean, definitely willful rejection of truth implies error. Don't assume, like those who haven't had any logic classes always do, that you can go the other direction. Error does not imply the willful rejection of truth. Okay?
Obviously, I'm not Melchizedek.
It might just merely be giving untruth form in your mind. Right? There's no willfulness about it. Okay? All right. So, see, there is a statement. See, that's a derivative sort of a thing. You can't treat that as just some sort of a foundational thing with a simple equal sign, and you know, you'll be confused. It's like, okay, every time I see error in the book, it involves the willful rejection of truth. No, you're going to be very confused if you assume that. Like Chris was just saying, Melchizedek's can be an error. And if you think that the definition of error is the willful rejection of truth, you're saying that Melchizedek had the willful... No, he did not. No. You'll be very confused. You'll have error in your interpretation, right?
We commonly do this when we look at other people. We see they're obviously in error, but then we conclude that they're...
It was willful.
Willful rejection of goodness.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah, right. Another derivative one in here. And I think you even kind of paused on it because you noticed it. You know, you saw, you know, also towards the end there, the very conflicting presence of truth and untruth. You go, okay, that's a nice little pair of opposites. Fact and falsehood. And I could tell you going, wait a minute, shouldn't it be fact and figment? Because you've heard this story before. Figment implies falsehood. But falsehood doesn't imply figment. Like we were just talking, you could have falsehood where it's fact in play. It's falsehood because there's evil. See, sometimes, and again, they're not always speaking in very simplistic, foundational terms. Sometimes they're speaking in derivative terms. You know, you've got the foundation, and what if you put two of those things together? You know. A lot of times they're speaking that much. You can't assume. So that's one of the important things about this chart is to try to help you with sorting out what are the foundational elements so that parts of the book where they are, you know, combining blocks, like they're bringing associativity and unity together, that doesn't confuse you. This is two things together here, rather than, oh, these two things are innately together. No, they've been brought together. They aren't innately together. For instance, there's an absolute of mind and there's an absolute of spirit, and they're absolutely separate facts. The third source and center and the second source and center aren't the same fact. Right? So, but many times they're working together, like we're just thinking about here. If there is evil, there is also error. It's inescapable. Yep.
So as we go through life,
mm-hmm.
You know, it almost sounds like we're probably in error a lot.
Right.
You know, and maybe some evil along with it, but...
Yep.
It almost is a little bit scary. In other words, it almost gets to the point where, gee, you know, because the reality of error and evil is probably so much more than I can ever understand, and I'm probably in error a lot, you know, that kind of thing. It's a little bit scary.
And so why shouldn't it get scary? That brings in another element in the book that try to clear up something that we've been ever confused about. What are you judged on?
Intention.
No, you're not judged on your intentions. Again, because I know what you're thinking, but remember we use the word intention inappropriately. You're judged on your motives. But people use the word intention for motive all the time. You're judged on your spiritual motives, not on your false intentions, not on the false forms in your mind. You have mindal intentions. You're not judged on your mindal intentions. You're judged on your spiritual motives. Was it your desire to give badness form in your mind. And if it wasn't, you're fine.
Even though you did.
Even though you did. You're not judged upon, you know, the unfortunate, immature forms in your mind.
Wasn't premeditated.
So had Lucifer's motives been good, he would have accepted forgiveness.
Well, initially his motives were good.
But then they
but eventually they flipped.
Right? Still, it flipped, but yeah.
He went from evil to sin. His motives became bad. But initially his motives were good. Sublimely good. More good than you can even imagine good being good. Right? Super good motives.
Motives are good. Decisions were evil.
Right? Initially he was confused. Okay, and let me go ahead and bring it in right here. There's another key spot in the book that you want to always keep in mind as you try to sort this out is right after the inevitabilities. That paragraph that immediately follows the inevitabilities up there in paper 3, section 5.
Page.
If you want to go to the page, you can. It's page 52 in the single column. It's that paragraph right after, you know, the 9 bullet points of the inevitabilities. That are on single column, page 51. You flip it over, and there's this paragraph that's talking about some things, and they've got a couple parentheticals that are very handy to remember, to memorize, and bring into play as you try to keep it straight in your head about error and evil.
Give me your favorite chapter again?
Paper 3, section 5.
Okay, sorry.
Another definition you can keep in mind for error. Error is unwise judgment.
Throughout the universe?
If you look in the middle of that paragraph, kind of, there's a sentence that starts, the only evolutionary world without error, and then parenthetically they say the possibility of unwise judgment. They're speaking about a world, so they're thinking, you know, there's the possibility in the external world, but, you know, just as an inner life fact, okay, error is unwise judgment. Just try to burn that in your memory. Fall back on that a lot. Touch on that. So, if my judgment was just unwise, I had good motives, but I didn't have the requisite wisdom to translate that good motive into a true intention. Okay, I had unwise judgment. You know, that's the process that gets you from a motive to an intention, a spiritual motive to a mental intention. That's error, but it's just mere error. Okay. And then further down, they give you one for evil as mistaken judgment. And it reminds you that mis prefix is, you know, the Revelators want you to use the mis prefix in a proper way. Mistaken, wrongly taken. Okay. You know, this bit about you're thinking of taking a hold of a relationship to spirit. Did you take a hold of it rightly or wrongly? Well, I desire to take a hold of it rightly. Okay, cool. But did you succeed? You know, are you still so immature that badness sometimes looks like goodness to you? You know, and so you took a hold of badness, but you desired to take a hold of goodness. Okay, but, you know, either way, you've wrongly taken a hold of it. You know, of a relationship to unity. You know, evil is mistaken judgment. But you didn't, it wasn't deliberately wrong what you did, but it was wrong. Okay, so it's just evil, not sin. Okay, but see that mistaken, wrongly taken in, it reminds you of this faith grasping is actually going to get a hold of unity and bring it into play in your mind. Make your mind do unity stuff. Rather than just individuality stuff, you know, to give it this continuumness, you know, like getting your third adjutant to work as the spirit of courage instead of just the energy of loyalty, loyal to a certain individuality, instead of courage predicated on the desire to have a relationship to. This unbrokenness of unity. You know, you say unity in this situation demands that I act thusly. I do not want to disrupt that background continuumness. I don't want to break that unity that's there. And so I step forth, putting myself secondary. You know, I may die, but it's worth dying because the unity is worth dying for. Right? You're using it as a spirit of courage now, not just the energy of loyalty to some individuality. You know, I faithfully follow that individual that's shaped like my master around, a dog's loyalty to a particular individuality. Yeah. Okay, so just always have those playing in your mind. Evil is mistaken judgment. Error is unwise judgment. Okay, so that's a good one, besides what we've been talking about here. Let's see, some other things that we have there. You can reflect on your own on most of it. You see they're kind of just trying to get you to have some of these things in play. The one other main thing maybe that John was alluding to just a little bit ago is another way of thinking about, which they're teeing up here, thinking about the word goodness. We're obviously talking about our experiential lives here. We're not talking abstractly about existential existence. So when we talk about goodness, we are obviously aren't talking about perfectness. You know, some existential perfectness. We're talking about a goodness that has some relevance to my life. I mean, I don't live in an existential domain. I don't live in the central universe. I mean, goodness defined existentially is of no use to me. How do I define the word goodness? You know, and hence, what do you mean by badness, ungoodness? Goodness out here in an evolutionary domain is perfectingness. Something is good if it's perfecting. Okay? To give goodness form in your mind, right, is to relate to a perfectingness, not this attempt to, I'm going to relate to existential perfectness. You won't succeed in that. You can't know that. That's completely beyond your comprehension. You're delusional if you think you can, right? What you can slowly begin to understand is, you know, that when you look out, yeah, everything is existentially imperfect. That's not news. It is of no use. The question is that perfecting? Is that perfecting? You know, do I see the flow of truth going towards perfection in that? And it might be difficult at times. What I'm looking at might be the orgy of darkness and death. Yeah, but the second it's brought into existence, it becomes part of the evolutionary phenomenon, and there's a flow that begins to go through it, through those facts of the orgy of darkness and death. There's a perfectingness that begins to happen with them. No matter what you throw out there, the Supreme grabs a hold of it and starts moving it towards the light and life of the grand universe. You know, and so those are the real challenges. A really delightful white blob, that is moving towards perfection is one thing. But what about something that appears to be just black as black can be? Can you get to the point where you can see the perfectingness in it as well and say, it doesn't appear to be good, but it is? Well, but I'm used to basing all of my decisions just on the very surface of it. If it appears to be black, it's black, period, end of story. No. Slavery is indispensable to the early progress of civilization. Oh, I reject that. I see slavery as nothing but absolute blackness. Well, that's false. Well, how do you know that? Well, because despite the appearance of it, I've been told about the reality of it, which I can't know. Slavery will always appear, once I have some sort of objective consciousness, it will appear bad to me.
And it's better than killing everybody.
But in the proper time frame in an evolutionary system, There's a perfectingness there. It's good. Matter of fact, you know, it's indispensable. There isn't a single world in the entire universe of universes that gets the light and life except through, in an early stage, slavery. It's indispensable. There is no other way to get the light and life except for slavery in an early state. Same way with war, social classes, profit motive. All kinds of things. And just a little aside, a place in the book where they really try to teach you that sort of perspective is in the marriage and family papers, those three papers, where they try to give you lots of historical examples where from our current perspective, when we're told about this, we go, oh, that's horrible. That's absolutely bad. And then the next sentence says, yes, but that's the only way that you can produce this really positive thing that you go, oh, yeah, yeah, that's good. Therefore, what appears to you to be absolutely bad is not. Right? You aren't thinking about it objectively. There's all kinds of examples of that, you know, in those papers.
So
try to teach us this.
Take this for example. So it's really part of the supreme, the evolutionary process, so to speak, what you're talking about in terms of, you know, the relativity of goodness and badness is definitely relative depending on how far along evolved you are, so to speak. But when you're in Havona and you're living in a perfected existence, do you think they have that? Do you think they don't experience that, do they?
No, they have none of the inevitabilities. Or imply. There's no contrast. You know, and wow, that seems like a dead battery to me. Yeah, I mean, see, you can't even imagine how there could be any point to Havona, right? It'll be a long time before you can understand. I mean, what good is a domain where altruism is impossible? All right, on and on you can go with the inevitabilities. No, these are the things, you know, you start to think in evolutionary terms. Humans have always been confused because they've falsely imposed an existential perspective on things, and you'll never understand. So, you know, think about how complicated this gets now. You know, I mean, you're let's say you're thinking about, the whole election process, you know, the political process. Generalize it to the political process. All kinds of assessments are constantly made in the political domain about that's good and that's bad. How do you know? Seriously, really? I mean, do you encompass all seven super universes over countless hundreds of trillions of years and you can declare that that is bad? I mean, again, read the marriage and family papers. There's all kinds of, that's bad. And then they say, no, actually, it's not really bad. That's really good. Well, it appears to be bad. Yeah, it appears. I mean, there is no humility in humanity. Okay, that's why this book is in my lap. Okay? Self-righteousness passes for righteousness now. I mean, how can you know which candidate should be elected? Seriously. I mean, it may be the only way to get to light in life is for that candidate you see as abjectly bad to be elected. You can't know these things absolutely. It may be, I mean, you know, how many times have we thought about it? It's like, wait a minute, that's just the opposite of what I've always thought or what humans have always thought. Yeah, basically everything is like that. You're a little child. Almost everything is the opposite, really, of what it appears to you. Yeah. Do you have any humility about this? It doesn't mean that it's six of one and a half and does another and you shouldn't vote. I mean, you should try, but you need to approach these things with some humility instead of this self-righteousness that everyone approaches it with, where they're absolutely certain they know which one is good and which one is bad. You do not know that. You can't know that.
You do have an inkling of when you are good or bad.
Okay, now let's go to that. Okay? That was the other thing I was going to bring up. It's like, well, what about me when I think I'm doing a good thing or a bad thing? This, again, humans are, because of our encirclement of the Holy Spirit, the words right, wrong, good, bad, whatnot, are put into our minds. But none of us have any idea of how to apply them. There's only one thing that we apply them. The only thing that seems possible to apply them to is our moray system. Whatever your moray system is what you initially apply this to. Right? And so you say, if it conforms with your moray system, you call it good or right. If it doesn't conform with the moray system, you call it bad or wrong. Okay? Everyone starts that way. You can't start any other way. Prior to age six, you aren't even circuited in the Holy Spirit. It can't be any other way.
Doesn't the adjuster come in at some point, or six?
No, the key thing is this encirclement in the Holy Spirit. The three cosmic intuitions, the second cosmic intuition, you know, directly, gives you the potential to objectively discriminate right from wrong. It's possible, but it's not easy to get there. There is a conformity with the cosmos, a right, but it's with the cosmos. Okay, what is the cosmos? I mean, if I say that, you know, a moral meaning is a meaning that conforms with the cosmos, like, okay, rather than conforms with the moray system, you know, we've always thought that moral means conforms with the moray system, but revelation say, no, it's conformity with the cosmos. Like, okay, what's the cosmos? Yeah, indeed, what is it? Right now, I can't poke it in any tangible way. I might be able to look up the moray, you know, our code of ethics or whatever in a book somewhere. You know, the Pharisees made sure they wrote down every jot and tittle of it, so you got to look it up, right? I'm moral if I'm conforming to what's in this book. You start out really not knowing what moral is, knowing that it exists, and knowing that everything that you initially think it is, it isn't. Because there's no way for you to think anything but moray system. And you don't have to have any consciousness of the moray system. This is what no one understands until they begin reflective thinking. Everyone has a worldview. Everyone has a moray system that absorbed into their mind at a very young age. And it sits there as the predicate for all of your thoughts, all of your decisions, all your actions unrecognized until you begin to think reflectively. There is a set of initial assumptions that you base all of your thoughts and actions on and that you use as the reference for what is right and wrong.
Period. Doesn't it say in the papers about the adjuster tells you, is trying to tell you what's right or wrong?
Right. How this works is, I mean, the fundamental way that you can do it is with the three cosmic intuitions, right? With the encirclement of the Holy Spirit. The adjuster comes in to amplify that, to make it less of a still small voice, the reality response. It does that because it's a literal blob, a literal fragment that helps to bring this initial fuzzy feeling, you know, I think this is right and this is wrong. It helps to bring that to a focus and makes it solid in your mind so that it's easier to get a hold of. Kind of helps to put it before your eyes. Because initially you have a hard time having a broad enough field of view to really kind of encompass that recognition of the three cosmic intuitions. And so it helps to bring it to a smaller space. It's like a condensation of the cosmos, after all, that fragment. You know, it's a fragment of harmony. The cosmos is the universal harmony. It's a fragment of that. So it helps to bring it to a focus, helps you to be able to
focus.
To get to this point where you might really be making an objective discrimination between right and wrong. But again, subjectively, in terms of how it feels, you can have nothing. What can be going on in your mind can have absolutely nothing to do with the objective reality of the cosmos. And it will feel absolutely right or wrong to you. You've got to know that. And, I mean, in that mode, the adjuster will just make it all the more definitive in your mind. but it might not really be. You got to know this. You got to have the humility that no matter how poignant that initial feeling is, you are absolutely certain this is right. It may not be. You have an absolute dimension of your personality. You can take a negative and absolutely make it a positive in your mind. And you don't have to want to do that. So you've got to be very cautious about, taking what initially appears to be immutable and chiseling it on a stone. Got to be careful about immediately assuming that the appearance is the reality. Let's chisel it on stone and never think about that again. We know this, period, end of story. Right, you've gone to dogma there. So, again, that might feel a little scary. It's like, well, what if I do the wrong thing? Well, if that wasn't your conscious motive, it's okay. That which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. As long as you tried your best, that's honored. You don't have to worry. It's not like you've been taught where you walk on the knife edge of taboo. And the slightest transgression of taboo, which is what everyone thinks sin is, right, damns you to hell. Right? Sin is not transgression of taboo. You know, taboos are the shell knots in the moray system. It's not about the moray system. Sin is not about the moray system. You know,
not about the Ten Commandments.
Things that you do socially to try to deal with the difficulties of sex. That's the moray system. It doesn't have anything to do with sin. Okay, and that blows up what everyone has always thought. I mean, what most likely will you apply the word moral to? Some sexual thing. No, that's the moray system, how we deal with sex. And the fact that I'm biologically a blob of protoplasm with sex hunger, and females are fundamentally blobs of protoplasm with a maternal instinct. Okay? How we deal with those, the socialization of those biologic facts, that's the moray system. It doesn't have anything to do with morality. That's just a very huge step. It's like, I mean, if you did, you know, you see, like you said, you can't help but have a clean slate after that. I mean, everything that everyone's ever thought about right and wrong, this book evaporates.
What about a desire to believe in God? Is that something different?
Again, I mean, that's just you have an individual impulse to direct yourself towards the other, towards God. But that doesn't have anything to do with this. What about the whole?
Well, I mean, all the aspects thereof.
I would like to identify with that part, with God. Okay. Now, what follows that is, well, do you know that in order to properly identify with that part, he's in synchrony with the whole. So for you to really identify with him, you have to also synchronize with the whole. This distinction is vital.
Right, but also talking
okay,
about
just,
sharing
your life. I know, but just on that. But see, this is going somewhere.
Okay.
I can have this definitive desire to connect to God, but I can do it improperly. If my effort to identify with God is not synchronized with the whole,
can I really do it improperly?
Yeah.
Maybe improperly once you've evolved all the way, but improperly at any stage, so to speak, is it really?
Yes.
Is it relative?
You can. I mean, obviously, the closer you get to fusion, the less this is in play. Okay. There's going to be no evil after fusion, but short of fusion, evil is in play.
But my point is more like that. Every step you take towards doing that, whether is in my mind a step in the right direction, even though
maybe
it may not be.
Maybe.
Well,
again, just remember.
Even if it's
The tricky thing. See, the tricky thing is, Lucifer thought he was stepping towards that divinity. Okay. Now, obviously, if you remain humble. As long as you remain humble, you won't copy after him. But the tricky thing is, the moment there's any pride, Like, let's say you take a couple of proper steps. Ooh, and it feels really cool. You got to be very careful. Right, the moment, like some of the 70 evangelists took some proper steps, and they told Jesus about how cool it felt inside, he hit them like a ton of bricks. If you knew how close you are to the iniquitous one, with you don't have your pride is building in your mind. It's very easy for you to take a positive result and turn it around towards yourself. Rather than saying to God be the glory, it's to you be the glory. Look at how close I'm getting to God.
You can do that, but I mean, a lot of people, I mean, you can also not do that.
You also can. But the whole point of this is the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion. It's not to talk about what Lucifer didn't do. It's to talk about what Lucifer did, what we will do. And it's about that pride thing where, you know, you, as soon as the self becomes exalted, these things all go very negative. Okay? Okay, maybe we should try to read a little bit more.
This is interesting. You said you started out, you said it's going to take half the class.
Why are we not surprised?
Okay, let me just make sure that I didn't... I think we got all the basics that I wanted to get out of there. Okay, so let's get into this next thing. This is one of the real, real big issues you'll see by the first statement that they make.
Section 1, True and False Liberty. Of all the perplexing problems growing out of the Lucifer Rebellion, none has occasioned more difficulty than the failure of immature evolutionary mortals to distinguish between true and false liberty.
Okay, so here's a great example of what I was just trying to speak to you about. So of all the perplexing problems, okay, none has occasioned more difficulty than this failure to distinguish between true and false liberty. The moment that you get this very powerful, in many ways most powerful, spiritual concept in your mind, liberty... spiritual liberty. It's if you have any impatience, pride, if you want to race forward at all with this new concept, to sort of realize this new concept, guaranteed, it's false liberty, not true liberty. Because no child of God automatically can distinguish between true and false liberty. And as you start to race forward, you'll quickly outrun that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit that you're given. I mean, yeah, the first step, because of that encirclement by grace, will be a true step. But after that, you know, you've used up that innate wisdom, right? You'll start to make unwise judgments and, you know, and mistaken judgments. It'll all start unraveling very quickly. To distinguish between true and false liberty, liberty is not innately true. Love is not innately true. There's true love and false love, and I'm talking about genuine love. Not talking it's false because it's, you know, lust that you're calling love or something. No, that sixth level of meaning love can be true or false. Okay, believing that all you have to do is consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father and get a hold of liberty or love, and then everything else happens automatically. No. There's a second consecration. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother in order to guarantee that it's true and not false. And if you don't do that, it will be false. And the revelators try to point this out many times about using the last 2,000 years with Christianity as an example. Right? Christians who want definitively want to love, for instance, and they say, yes, but... their love, they quickly outstripped their innate ability for that love to be true. And they quickly began to love falsely. And they have produced vast evil in the world because of their efforts to love. It's like, well, how could the effort to love produce, you know, if it's false love, it will produce evil. False liberty will produce evil. You won't get the goodness that you envision. You'll get the opposite. Change without growth is potential evil. These are very difficult things. It's of all the perplexing problems. See, this is very perplexing. We so want to do these spiritual things.
And what you're saying,
but we're impatient.
Love so, itself is not the falseness of it.
It's what you do with it. It's what you do with that sixth level of meaning. You can use it positively or negatively. Spirit is not innately divine. Spirit's a double-edged sword. You can use it well, for well or for ill. It's you have free will. It's in your hands. See, again, it's not like all I have to do is grab the good stuff and bring it in and everything happens automatically. Just don't grab that bad stuff out. There is no bad stuff out there. You grab all the good stuff and then you either use it appropriately or you use it inappropriately. And it's not what we've always thought in the dual spiritism model. There is no dual spiritism. It's in your hands, your free will hands. Whether or not liberty produces a positive or a negative result. And see, like I said, it's none is occasion more difficulty because this is such a powerful concept. It burns so brightly in your mind, like we talked about with the God of Liberty. Okay, so we go, okay, well, what's the basic issue? I'm going to explain here. How does it get to be false instead of true?
True liberty is the quest of the ages and the reward of evolutionary progress. False liberty is the subtle deception of the error of time and the evil of space. Enduring liberty is predicated on the reality of justice, intelligence, maturity, fraternity, and equity.
Notice they didn't say equality, they said equity, not merely spiritual. Cosmic, three-dimensional, not two-dimensional. Okay, so that's the first thing.
Say what true liberty is. They said it's the quest of the ages.
Right, no, that last sentence. Enduring liberty is predicated on the reality of justice. Okay, so step one. It will never be true if it isn't definitively liberty in law. Justice is applied law.
Otherwise, it's anarchy.
Is law evolutionary?
Otherwise, it's self-righteousness. Right? Liberty in law. Thy liberty in law. Why did we used to sing that? Okay? In fact, we don't sing that so much in the forest. Why this book is in my lap.
I sing that in the seventh
grade. Okay? Right? We know this truth. They're reminding you of this truth. Okay, it's predicated on. True liberty cannot exist outside of law. And the moment you think it does is the moment you're going to go astray. It's like, well, I don't like the bonds of law. Yeah, you're self-righteous in desire, not righteous in desire. Righteousness is about conformity with the law of the cosmos. Self-righteousness is saying, screw law. I am law. I am cosmos. I am I, right? And I want to manifest unbridled liberty. It's my right. So predicated on the reality of justice, applied law. Right, to apply law, the parenthetical there, intelligence, maturity, fraternity, equity, right? To be able to properly recognize and apply law, you're going to need intelligence, maturity, fraternity, and equity. Right? Just reminding you of that. It's a complex thing to properly apply law. So that's one thing. Then they also throw out that interesting little thought, false liberty is a subtle deception of the error of time and the evil of space. OK, Okay?
That's funny.
Now, we were just talking about error. We know error is in parallel to that truth thing. Remember, a few papers back, we had that statement about the facts of time and the truths of eternity. Oh, well, that's another interesting way to think about error in contrast to truth. The truths of eternity, oh, if I relate to time as if it was eternity, that would be the errors of time, right? That, think about how we do that a lot, right? Treating time as if it was eternity, this moment as if it was in eternity. No, this is just a passing moment of time. So, error of time is in contrast, you know, to truths of eternity. Evil of space.
What's that?
Like, why that? Okay, space is about separation. Okay, you know, separation between two objects.
Not necessarily space.
Just the concept of space. Evil, that's you know, related to that unity issue. What's unity? Unity is continuumness. No separation. Continuumness. All right? See, if I fracture that continuumness, that unity, right, there's separation, the evil of space. The evil of separation.
So when I say I need my space, I'm...
Right? They're using time and space. See, and I give you another way of reflecting on those, the difference between error and evil. Okay, so that, you know, like we said, liberty is a very powerful word, is the quest of the ages. Okay, right, I mean, you are, okay, you're going to be animated about this. That just happens. Okay, what else do they say here?
Liberty is a self-destroying technique of cosmic existence when its motivation is unintelligent, unconditioned, and uncontrolled. True liberty is progressively related to reality and is ever regardful of social equity, cosmic fairness, universe fraternity, and divine obligations.
Okay, now we're not going to go into the physics of that last statement, but again, if you go in the library, you can find a little one-page handout that's entitled Cosmic Expressions of the Six Levels of Meaning. And there's a group of handouts about the six levels of meaning. This is one of the great examples in the book of a cosmic expression. You've got the initial up the ladder of the levels of meaning, but then you lift that up and you construct a multifaceted cosmic form out of what formerly was the rungs of the ladder. And you know, that handout points out how each of those things relate back to levels of meaning that have been uplifted: social equity, cosmic fairness, universe fraternity, and divine obligations. The key thing we want to point out here, though, is not the physics of that. Is that, what is that? Those are the facets of what? They're obviously wanting to have a cosmic perspective on something, a cosmic character of something. What? Those are the facets of personal responsibility. You should be able to sense that if you reflect on divine obligation. Okay? Personal responsibility, those are the facets of personal responsibility. So they're saying that true liberty is progressively related to reality. You know, it's got that perfecting this thing happening. See, and is ever regardful, right? It's predicated on the facets of personal responsibility. So if you haven't fully encompassed cosmically personal responsibility, that's going to get you to false liberty instead of true liberty. All those different elements. And then in the previous statement, when they said unintelligent, unconditioned, uncontrolled, well, we saw the intelligence thing there when they talk about justice. Yeah. What about the unconditioned, uncontrolled? I'll explain those in just a minute. But another thing that I wanted to bring out here, that liberty is self-destroying. That that should remind you of another one of the places in the book, like that unwise judgment, mistaken judgment thing to kind of keep in the back of your mind. Another spot in the book to keep in your back of your mind when you're thinking about error, evil, sin, and iniquity is up in paper 118. Let's see, and it's on, it's single column page 1301. It's the next to the last paragraph of paper 118, section 7. And let me skip the first sentence of that paragraph and just read through the rest of that paragraph, that next to the last paragraph. It says, personality endowment comes from the Father and imparts unique prerogatives of choice to the living system. But if personality has the prerogative of exercising volitional choice of reality identification, and if this is a true and free choice, then must evolving personality also have the possible choice of becoming self-confusing, self-disrupting, and self-destroying. The possibility of cosmic self-destruction cannot be avoided if the evolving personality is to be truly free in the exercise of finite will. That sequence, burn it in your mind. Self-confusing, self-disrupting, self-destroying, self-destruction. Error, evil, sin, and iniquity. Okay. Error is self-confusing. Evil is self-disrupting. See, you're breaking that continuumness. You fractured it. Sin is self-destroying, right? You're actually going to do damage to your sin, your soul. And iniquity is self-destruction. It's gone.
Cessation of
iniquity. Right? You've evaporated the meaning and value of your soul. You've destroyed yourself. All right, so that's another key one to have ready to reflect on. You know, if they use the word error or evil somewhere, error is self-confusing. Error is unwise judgment. You know, you can, and that might help you to interpret properly their statement about error. Okay.
So some other place they talk about, in order for you, 1 minute. You'd be totally free.
We're going to get to that. That's in this section.
Oh, it is?
Yep. You're jumping in. so see, that one invokes paper 118 when they say liberty is self-destroying. See, sin. Okay. That's what you should hear when you read that, if you've got a very synthesized, objective relationship to the revelation. Okay, look at this next paragraph.
Liberty is suicidal when divorced from material justice, intellectual fairness, social forbearance, moral duty, and spiritual values. Liberty is non-existent apart from cosmic reality, and all personality reality is proportional to its divinity relationships.
So you see in that first sentence, immediately juxtaposed to the last sentence of the previous paragraph, is another one of these lists. Again, those are cosmic facets. Those are the facets of self-control. So in order, you have personal responsibility and self-control. Right? That's what you need, the recognition of personal responsibility and the exercise of self-control, if you are to ensure that liberty is true in your mind and not false. Okay, and see, it's very sweeping, holistic, and complex. You know, these are long lists of complex things. But boil it down to begin with to just the recognition of personal responsibility and the exercise of self-control. That unintelligent, unconditioned, uncontrolled, see, unconditioned, absent the recognition of personal responsibility. Uncontrolled, yes, absent of the exercise of self-control. And it's like, well, why didn't they just say that? Because your job is to synthesize the revelation and discover these truths. Okay, so that's the key thing that they're wanting to stress here. Personal responsibility and self-control. you know that really the only job you have is to work on self-mastery, to work towards self-mastery. That is the bottom line job. If you're working on that, everything else will take care of itself.
And not just in this life.
Now and forevermore is about self-mastery. From here to eternity is about self-mastery.
You don't think you ever get there.
You can't, because as soon as you master a given self, your self is bigger, and there's more to master again.
In other words, God is always one God ahead of you.
Right? I mean, there's always more to do because your self is ever growing. Every time it's grown, it isn't grown pre-mastered. It's just grown. And then it's in your free will hands to master that self. Yeah. Think about how much work it will take to master a self that's so vast it has a relationship to co-absoluteness. You know, beyond the fourth outer space level age. You know, I mean, right, I mean, what a self-mastery job.
There's more exclamation points about that.
Okay. But you start now.
What a technique.
Just keep focusing. I have a personal responsibility that I need to recognize, and I have to be working on self-control more and more and more towards self-mastery.
I never thought of it that way.
Okay.
Lucifer was sure he was mastered.
Yeah. And the moment you assume that there's no more self-mastery required is the moment that you start veering off that self-righteousness to believe that you're innately divine, pre-mastered.
There's no point in putting off this self-mastery business
at all. Seeking first.
It's the only thing in front of you. Nothing else to do. Okay. All right, so see, that's the meat right there. And now they're just going to kind of speak about that a little bit more.
Unbridled self-will and unregulated self-expression equal unmitigated selfishness, the acme of ungodliness. Liberty without the associated and ever-increasing conquest of self is a figment of egoistic mortal imagination. Self-motivated liberty is a conceptual illusion, a cruel deception. License masquerading in the garments of liberty is the forerunner of abject bondage.
Yeah.
See that a lot.
Right. I mean, again, you think you're escaping the shackles of law. I'm not going to do that liberty and law thing. You create your own law that infinitely shackles you, cutting you off from all reality. Abject bondage. Complete separation from reality. So you can see how they're talking. You know, unbridled self-will, right? Lack of recognition of personal responsibility, and unregulated self-expression, right? The lack of self-control. How do you get unmitigated selfishness? Okay, you start out as a child of God, naturally selfish. Unmastered, you're selfish. How does it get to unmitigated selfishness? If you bring in spirit energy. If you want that selfishness to be amped up and more resilient, more resistant to change, put some spirit energy into it. Well, how might that spirit energy get into my selfishness? Well, what if I grab the hold of the concept of spiritual liberty, of liberty that automatically brings spirit energy into play? And you'll get that, you'll get spiritualized selfishness, which goes nowhere but self-righteousness. It's so easy to spiritualize your selfishness because you're not made a mastered self. And you start out selfish. Your first word was probably mine. Okay? It may still, for a lot of people, still is about their only word in their vocabulary. And the moment that you get some spirit energy into that mindful self, okay, you got a problem. You're going to juice up that selfishness with spiritual energy. Okay? And it's going to, that selfishness is now not going to grow arithmetically anymore. It's going to grow geometrically. Right? It'll be unmitigated selfishness. Right? We don't live long enough to get to unmitigated selfishness arithmetically. Right? This is the spirit energy is a double-edged sword. And you can see how they're, you know, very, very poetic terms, you know, speaking about how the self can appear to be the cosmos.
So self-mastery is almost like selfish mastery.
That just about guarantees that life is going to go very badly.
Yeah, and what if you have that worldview that thinks that the self is innately evil and you want to try to separate yourself from it? You can't. You're a self. So what you're doing is, I'm going to try to totally avoid this thing and just let it be, and maybe no, that means you guaranteed that thing, because what are you doing when you're not? You're trying to focus on unity. You're bringing spirit energy into a selfish, immature self. It's going to go to unmitigated selfishness. It's just, if you try to set that self aside, you're guaranteed you're going to go down this false path. You need to put it right in front of you. Okay? There's no getting rid of it. You're a self, period, end of story.
Face the fact.
It's your job to master that self.
Cable doesn't work.
Right? And if you don't master that self will cease to exist.
But you're so right. So many people have that. Huh. I've created evil. Right.
Right. Or all things of the self are evil. No, the self is not evil. The self is just a fact. You know, you're calling the self evil because you recognize it's not unity, it's individuality, and you've assumed that unity is good and individuality is bad. That's your definition of bad, individuality. No, bad is a unity word, not an individuality word. There's all this confusion. Okay, keep going here.
True liberty is the associate of genuine self-respect. False liberty is the consort of self-admiration. True liberty is the fruit of self-control. False liberty, the assumption of self-assertion. Self-control leads to altruistic service. Self-admiration tends toward the exploitation of others for the selfish aggrandizement of such a mistaken individual as is willing to sacrifice righteous attainment for the sake of possessing unjust power over his fellow beings.
Just notice they're playing all these things together. You had unjust, remember the liberty and law statement that they gave you before, they're reminding you of that. You obviously have all kinds of stuff about self-control here. Notice the such a mistaken individual. Ah, evil, right? Mistaken judgment. And see, as I said, you need to put all this stuff together to appreciate the beautiful composition here, how they're bringing all these things together and playing them in a story for you. So, true liberty is the associate of genuine self-respect. Genuine self-respect is on the fourth level of meaning, at the level of kindness, the level of kin-likeness. That first little bit, that lowest level of objectivity, you get up on the first level up out of the lower domain, on that fourth level of meaning, and you have that initial unamped up, just objective perspective on the self. You know, respect means looking back at, right? You can look back at the self finally. Respect, like a spectacle, right? Yeah, respect. If you go up to the, if you take it up any higher than that, that sense of self, it goes up to self-esteem, and it's starting to rot on the fifth level of meaning. Okay, you're starting to think that, you know, you're the whole instead of a part. Right? I mean, that's the moral level. Moral is about conformity with the cosmos, with the whole. Right? See, you're going to start to falsely aggrandize yourself. I'm more than just a part. And if you take it all the way up to the sixth level of meaning, the level of love, that's self-admiration. That would be a false use of the sixth level of meaning, self-love, right? And we're talking genuine love, only you're not directing it towards others, you're directing it towards yourself. You're using that full spiritual level for yourself. See, false liberty is the consort of self-admiration. So that's how you, it gets started, is that false exaltation of self. True liberty is the fruit of self-control, like we just discovered. It's the only way that true liberty can manifest is via self-control. False liberty, the assumption of self-assertion. I have sovereignty in the inner domain, and I have the recognition of liberty there. And I believe that I am everything, fundamentally. So that inner life sovereignty, by definition, should be manifest outward as self-assertion, right? With the belief that there's the self is innately divine, doesn't need to be controlled, right? That's all those people that have botched you, you know, thinking you got to go through this whole ascension scheme, learning self-control, yada, 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 right? You know, the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, right? No, there's no, self is innately properly controlled. It's innately divine. Just apply it, right? And look at how you're applying it as the son of self-love. You've fallen in love with yourself. Really love, you know? Real love. Full spiritual phenomenon, you know, in your mind. Not just some foolish notion down on the second level of meaning that you call love. You just have feelings for yourself. All right.
They used a perishable like fruit, so you could understand if you don't keep this in the fridge,
right,
it's going to start stinking.
Right.
Use the freezer.
Right, so you can you can see how they're bringing that all together. You know, willingness to sacrifice righteous attainment, right? Instead of righteousness, you're going to have self-righteousness. Okay, then they throw in one little quick thought there.
Even wisdom is divine and safe only when it is cosmic in scope and spiritual in motivation.
You know, just think about it in the simplest way, with the seventh adjutant. In order for it to be the spirit of wisdom, instead of just the energy of symmetry, the bottom-up, purely subjective thing of the energy of symmetry, and the only way to be the spirit of wisdom is to get at it from the top down. Okay. So it's just a reminder that even wisdom is divine and safe only when it is cosmic in scope. So you've gotten up in the upper domain, you've synchronized with the cosmos, and you're now re-engaging the lower domain, the apex of which is wisdom. See, it's spiritual and motivation. You actually have a coming down from the spirit, right, motivation. You're engaging that from the top down. And so they're just reminding you that even the fullness of the lower domain, even its apex, just in and of itself, is still subjective. Right? The only way to make any of it, including the apex, objective, is to get up and, you know, get things conforming with the cosmos, to take control of that self and make it reflect the cosmos. Not even the seventh adjutant is self-controlled. And that's what they're reminding you of. And so it's the whole ball of wax, your whole seven adjutant self needs to be controlled. Wisdom can be perverted. Unwise judgment. Right? Okay?
There is no error greater than that species of self-deception which leads intelligent beings to crave the exercise of power over other beings for the purpose of depriving these persons of their natural liberties. The golden rule of human fairness cries out against all such fraud, unfairness, unselfishness, and unrighteousness. Only true and genuine liberty is compatible with the reign of love and the ministry of mercy.
Okay, I mean, that's basically straightforward. We've kind of talked about that a lot already, but just notice how they end that. I was hinting to that. See, only true and genuine liberty is compatible with the reign of love and the ministry of mercy. Mercy is applied love. See, notice how they're bringing love and liberty together there. Because again, like I said, I mean, if you're in the mode of false liberty, you're in the mode of false love also. Okay, and they're reminding you that it can start out that insidiously, that the love thing is what can really get you going so zealously towards false liberty. This desire to love, so you really amp that up and you go, yeah, I want to love. Yeah, and first things first, let's start with me. All right? See, I mean, it's a very tricky, insidious thing, like they're trying to point out.
Subtle.
Right? It's very subtle, you know, that if there's any pride there, and we talked about this issue a lot in Forging Egg and Honor Steel, how subtle this pride thing is. And, that you've got to start working on a not speaking the language of the Lucifer Rebellion that we've begun to speak unwittingly now. We use the words pride and proud all the time now. And those are negative words. And now we use them almost universally in a as if they were positive words. I'm a proud parent, you say. And, again, there doesn't have to be a conscious self-absorption, but it's there unconsciously, whether you recognize it or not, when you speak that way about yourself. What you're saying is, look at my child. They've got these really cool things that they do, but, why do they have those cool things that they do? What's the source of that? Well, that's me, after all. Why I'm a proud parent. Look what I've done. Rather than, look at what God has done despite me. That child is subject to my hopeless genetics, and yet they do that. Right? But instead, you say, yeah, my child, but really, it's me that's the important thing here. Right? Or I'm a proud American. Laus Deo, not to you be the glory, to God be the glory. Right? If there's anything worth talking about this country, don't look to yourself as its source. Look to God. We have to stop speaking that way because unwittingly we're putting our minds in a form where it's favorable conditions to go towards self-righteousness. It's like, well, I'm not desiring that. It doesn't matter what you desire. It's physics. Lucifer didn't desire it either. The moment you start putting yourself in that prideful frame of mind, you will inexorably, like a ball falling when you let go of it in gravity, you will go there. You can't do anything else. So you have to get this stuff out of the shadows, bring it up. Wait a minute. I'm not proud. Right? I'm delighted, or whatever, right? Figure out what you really mean.
Grateful.
You don't mean you're proud. You don't mean that when all is said and done, it's all about you, and who cares about your kids? That's not what you mean, right? So it's very important for us to get on top of this again. We've lost sight of it. It doesn't say pride goes before a fall, unless you're talking about your kids. Proverbs doesn't say that, right? Okay. Oh, and maybe just one more thing. Again, why is this? Because pride is spiritual. It's a spirit word. You're injecting spirit energy into that selfish self. Yeah. Okay.
How dare the self-willed creature encroach upon the rights of his fellows in the name of personal liberty when the supreme rulers of the universe stand back in merciful respect for those prerogatives of will and potentials of personality? No being, in the exercise of his supposed personal liberty, has a right to deprive any other being of those privileges of existence conferred by the creators and duly respected by all their loyal associates, subordinates, and subjects.
Yeah, again, you see the basic things, like we've talked about in the previous paper. There's liberty on the one hand, there's self-assertion on the other hand. As soon as you start blurring them together, it starts to go astray. Supposed personal liberty. You're going beyond the inner life. You're bringing the outer life into play here. You're not sovereign out there. You're only sovereign in your inner life. Don't assume you have sovereignty out there. And they're bringing in the creators here. They touched on that at the beginning of the second paragraph in the preface. The gods neither create evil nor permit sin and rebellion. Okay, we talked about the create evil thing. I mean, evil isn't something that's out there, in the objective domain, in the external world. Okay, but we didn't talk about that nor permit sin and rebellion. I mean, almost every religion that's thought about God has got some rationalization scheme about the gods permitting sin and rebellion. No. It's like, well, how does it work then? What do the gods do? I mean, wouldn't you call letting the Lucifer rebellion happen permitting sin and rebellion? Isn't that how you would describe that? Yeah, if you aren't reflecting properly on the situation, you would. What do the gods do? The gods bestow personality and respect its free will. That's all they do. They bestow personality and respect free will. That's not permitting sin and rebellion. Okay? And you notice they use the words respect in this paragraph we just read. Think about it like that. Because you want to respect it, and you can, because when all is said and done with the Lucifer Rebellion, that was predicated on the actions of personalities, free will seemingly gone astray. However, what did the Supreme do with it? There's now more goodness than badness that's resulted from the Lucifer Rebellion. Respect free will. Don't presume that, that free will needs to be prevented from exercising. No. Right? God made it so that he couldn't touch it for a reason. You have absolute liberty.
That's a true dichotomy. God's the Father gives free will. He wouldn't then say, I don't like where this is going. At the last minute, I'm going to save him and pull him back from going over the cliff.
It isn't like the story, and it isn't like the story in the Bible. The Noah's Ark story in the Bible. Where it's like, oh, that wasn't such a great idea. No, that doesn't. Hey, it's infinite wisdom. Right? You respect free will because you know it's predicated on infinite wisdom in its bestowal. Trust. Right? It's not going to appear to be good initially, what free will does. That's why you can potentially trust.
You take faith to trust.
Trust, right? It'll be okay. You got to let it play out, for good or for ill.
And all I was going to say on top of what you said about more good has happened, mm-hmm. we are actually experiencing that good. We individuals, mm-hmm. If you look at it from a long-term perspective, our living on this rebellious world is going to, give us opportunities that we would have never had.
Tremendous opportunities.
So, or and experiences anyway.
And so there is that, which is kind of interesting, mm-hmm. that not only happened, but we happen to be even part of being able to experience right. that aspect.
Exactly. Like I said before we started reading, is the title of this paper The Problems of the Lucifer Rebellion or The Potentials of the Lucifer Rebellion? Which is it? Yeah. Well, it appears to be about the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion, if I'm reading that word, P-R-O-B. Yeah, but reflect on it, right? What's the truth that's flowing through the problems of the Lucifer Rebellion, the potentials of the Lucifer Rebellion, right? Find the revelation of truth, not just the disclosure of ink blobs on paper, right? Go beyond what it immediately says. There is no truth in the words. You can't convey truth with words.
There's a potential to get an understanding of error, evil, sin, and iniquity. There's a potential to get greater clarification here than on a non-rebellion planet.
Yes.
On a non-rebellion planet, you could leave the planet and still be hopelessly confused.
That sounds like the inevitabilities to me. Yes, right. That's the evolutionary domain, right? The only way to get it is via the contrast. That's the whole point.
We sure got it here.
It's the whole point. The greater the contrast, the greater the potential. And is there, you know, just like separating two plates of a capacitor, right? Okay, one last paragraph here.
Evolutionary man may have to contend for his material liberties with tyrants and oppressors on a world of sin and iniquity, or during the early times of a primitive evolving sphere. But not so on the Marantia worlds or on the spirit spheres. War is the heritage of early evolutionary man, but on worlds of normal advancing civilization, physical combat as a technique of adjusting racial misunderstandings has long since fallen into disrepute.
Okay, just a couple things there. That first part, you know, so the whole bit about contending for his material liberties with tyrants and oppressors, says on a world of sin and iniquity, yeah, or during the early times of a primitive evolving sphere, i.e., which developmental epoch most definitively, the material comfort era, right? That's the era of tyrants.
So we are.
Right? So, right, we have it twofold. We got the sin and iniquity, and we're in the material comfort era. So, ta-da, there's tyrants, okay? Tyrants and oppressors aren't just a sign of the fact that we're a rebellion world. Don't forget that. You take away sin and rebellion, you know, and we could still be in the material comfort era, right? Okay. So,
Yeah,
and now you maybe look Marantia worlds. Okay, you know, they're talking. Yeah, all of it are material worlds, but you know the Marantia progression up through the local universe, quote unquote, spirit spheres. I mean, you know, your spirit beginning spirit progression on the material worlds of the super universe proper. Right? They don't literally mean spheres made out of spirit substance. And then war is the heritage of early. Right, you have the four indispensables. We mentioned them earlier. Early progressing civilization. Yes, but on worlds of normal advancing civilization, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, you read the rest of that and that's why I think about war the way I do. Well, you're assuming we're advancing civilization. Not a valid assumption.
I'm proud to declare.
You need one of those
subtleties. War might still be indispensable to some degree. Maybe less than for other peoples some peoples on the planet. You know, we are a nation, you know, struggling to be a territorial state, yes. So we are trying to begin to leave war behind. But, yeah, just, you know, when you read that, read it very carefully. Notice it doesn't say civilization. It says advancing civilization. Yeah, if you're in past the early, you know, and you're into true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness as the four indispensables, okay. But Yeah. So these statements are all very complex like that, and you want to teach yourself to be precise about them.
Well, it's doubly challenging because when they bring in adjusting racial misunderstandings.
Yeah.
We still have racial misunderstandings.
And just maybe a parting thought there. Oh, wait a minute. Chris told me to look for the prefix miss and to not treat it flippantly. Wrong understandings. Oh, they're bringing in that mistaken judgment thing. Right? Evil. Yeah. The relators are very, very precise about that. If they use miss, they mean miss. They want you to think about wrong something. You know, which means, oh, you know, I shouldn't ever use misspell. Yeah, see, there's an example where we've taken a purely material thing and used spirit stuff to talk about it. Things aren't misspelt, wrongly spelt. They're incorrectly spelt, but they're not wrongly. You know, you completely gone beyond what it is. Right? See, we don't use the language properly. We have all this blurring like this.
We misuse the language.
Yes. or do we erroneously use it? Or just to get you to start to think about how poorly we use the language.
Easy thing, start to think.
Yeah.
People don't think very much.
No, they don't. Thinking. Not only, it's hard to get them to think, period, let alone reflectively think. Yeah. That's really tricky.
But they probably won't, as we've learned, until they get through this little age that we're in right now.
But a few can, and that's why the book is here. All can't. It's not a dispensational revelation. But a few can, and a few should. Because if a few don't, do what they should. Interregnum. Right? A few should. You don't even need a 1%. Never been more than 1% in any generation. But there's a few that always should.
More than three.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll continue on next time. You know, there's all kinds of great stuff in this paper. So those of you who are familiar with the paper know. But spend some time on your own. Obviously, you can't reflect too much on a section like this because it brings in all these complexities. So take some time on your own to see if you can begin to work on these things. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.